His program was the WBAI Evening News, heard daily at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion coming up. WBAI New York, WBAI.org, WBAI.org online.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
Welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to press for action on the climate emergency. This week, we want to talk about policy that creates sustainable systems. And we will begin by summarizing and commenting on recent news that's relevant to this topic. Now, this episode was researched and written by Zaida Melendez of Buffalo and Jack Baldwin of New York City. As always, thank you to James Cerrone for sound editing. An article on CNBC Online reported that the head of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, announced, depressingly but unsurprisingly, that in the article's words, climate change is not a main consideration for the central bank when formulating monetary policy. Powell made clear that, in his opinion, the Fed's role on this issue doesn't go beyond oversight of banks and the financial system as a whole. It's as if he doesn't think that climate change is his problem. Now, Powell said, quote, "We're quite actively exploring exactly what climate implications are for our supervisory, regulatory, and financial stability responsibilities." However, Powell clearly has no intention of allowing the Fed to set policy to deal with the climate crisis, leaving all that up to the Biden administration, whose own commitment to tackling climate change is less than ironclad, as we will discuss later in this program. Meanwhile, at the same event at which Powell spoke, Christine Lagarde, president of the European Central Bank, said, quote, "Our planet is burning and we central bankers could look on our mandate and pretend that it is for others to act and that we should simply be followers. I don't think so." Lagarde went on to suggest that the European Central Bank might consider climate change impacts in its purchases of corporate bonds. Hardly an earth-shattering proposal. Of course, what Lagarde and the European Central Bank will actually do remains to be seen. As we already know, when it comes to climate change, talk is cheap. And one might reasonably doubt that anything significant can be done about the crisis within the context of the economic system these people help maintain. However, at least Lagarde, unlike Powell, acknowledges a responsibility to help the world deal with the problem.
The New York Times a few weeks ago ran a devastating piece about a little-known London-based United Nations agency called the International Maritime Organization, or IMO for short. This is the main body in charge of regulating international shipping. The story claimed that international shipping emits as much carbon dioxide as the entire coal industry in the United States. Yet the IMO has repeatedly blocked all attempts at enacting strong emission regulations. According to that Times article, this is due to the shipping industry's influence on the agency. Industry representatives from member countries, in particular powerful emerging nations like China and Brazil, have a lot of influence there. Even a rule as basic as establishing maritime speed limits, which would curb emissions at least a teeny bit, has been successfully resisted by the industry. The unsustainability of shipping as it now exists was brought home last month by the sinking of the container ship Express Pearl off the coast of Sri Lanka, which, due to its cargo of oil and toxic chemicals, created an environmental disaster in that country similar to the 1989 Exxon Valdez incident. This is just the latest such spill and sinking, of course. Oil spills and chemical spills from shipping are pretty common, and a lot of them do not get big press coverage. Back in 1990, the Marshall Islands had signed a lucrative deal through which its government permitted ships from many countries for a fee to sail under the island's national flag. It was an American-based country that contracted to do all the paperwork. And as a result, representatives from that company took over the Marshall Islands seat at the IMO. So the company representatives are taking the Marshall Islands seat at this United Nations agency.
Unbelievable.
Now, because those very islands are in danger of vanishing from the face of the earth due to sea level rise caused by carbon emissions, the Marshall Islands are now advocating for the IMO to curb emissions caused by shipping. But their pleas have fallen on deaf ears, partly due to the opposition to emissions limits from the IMO's former president, Koji Sekimizu, because they would be detrimental to economic growth, says Sekimizu. So it's the same old story, short-term economic growth from short-term emissions with long-term economic and ecological destruction. While not trying to minimize the necessity of reducing and ultimately eliminating emissions from international shipping, there's an irony in the Times' implicit condemnation of emerging countries on this issue. If we turn the opening paragraph of that Times article on its head, then we could say U.S. coal plants are emitting as much CO2 as international shipping does. And the crucial difference, of course, is that international shipping involves over 100 countries all around the world. And for that reason, it's very difficult to control, whereas the U.S. coal industry involves only one country and thus would be relatively easy to control if the political will existed.
And guess who's up to their old tricks? Our favorite petroleum company, BP. Of all the big oil giants, BP has been the cleverest at greenwashing. After it dreamed up its Beyond Petroleum advertising tagline in the early years of this century, the campaign was so successful that BP became, for a time anyway, the most popular petroleum company. Meanwhile, this one corporation alone, from 1988 to 2015, generated over 1.5% of all industrial greenhouse gases worldwide, coming in at 11th place overall ahead of Chevron. Of course, that time period includes the infamous 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster, in which about 5 million barrels of oil were dumped into the Gulf of Mexico and 11 people died needlessly, a major hit to the company's image. So now BP has announced that it has invested in solar power projects covering 12 states, and the total estimated cost for this is $220 million. Well, that sounds like a lot of money, right? The catch is that BP's total operating revenue for 2020 was, drumroll please, $180.4 billion. And that was the worst year it experienced during the 16-year period from 2005 to 2020 inclusive. During its best year, 2013, its operating revenue was $379 billion. That works out to 1.2% of BP's 2020 revenue to be spent on solar power projects. And it's just over one half of 1% of their 2013 revenue. One half of 1% of the money that BP made in 2013, they're spending on solar. So it's as if a millionaire tossed you $1,000, not even the cost of a month's rent, right? And expected you to be eternally grateful to him. And that's what they do, by the way. So we need an economic system in which hugely wealthy corporations can't greenwash their way out of responsibility for their actions. Which brings us to the topic of today's show. Our April 20th show was intended as the first part of a two-part series. We examined three blueprints for ecological change: the Biden Plan, the Progressive Democrats' Green New Deal, or GND, and the Paris Accords. And we revealed the ways in which all those plans come up short. In this program, we will examine alternatives to those inadequate plans. We are inviting you, our audience, to do something that the mainstream media never, ever asks you to do. We want you to think beyond what is practical or realistic within the present unreal political system. It's time to imagine possibilities that are currently, quote, impossible, but which the science of climate change demands that we start taking seriously. Next year will be the 50th anniversary of the publication of The Limits to Growth, the seminal report by the Club of Rome. That book argued conclusively that humanity cannot indefinitely pursue endless growth on a finite planet. At the time of its release, it was widely ridiculed and scorned, particularly by those who thought, incorrectly, that it threatened corporate power. It did. But its authors have been proven right time and time again. Yet the plans that are being put forward even now to combat climate change and environmental degradation totally ignore this half-century old book's vital lessons. To repeat what we reported in part one of this two-part series, both the Paris Accords and the Democrats' GND fall far short of what needs to be done. And the Biden plan is a complete non-starter. In addition, Biden's recent actions, as revealed in the New York Times, you know, his approval of the Willow drilling project on Alaska's North Slope, his refusal to stop oil flowing through the Dakota Access Pipeline, and his seconding of Trump's decision to grant oil and gas leases on Wyoming federal land, all of these things suggest that he has no intention whatsoever of following through on even his most modest goals for reducing fossil fuel extraction.
The fundamental problem is that in all three plans, the Biden plan, the GND, and the Paris Agreement, there is acceptance to varying degrees of the economic system as it is. This is because the framers of those plans took the needs of corporations into account to a greater degree than the needs of people. You can see this in the fact that all three plans propose the insanely late date of 2050 as the deadline for attaining carbon net zero, let alone carbon absolute zero or near zero. So they're saying 2050 for net zero rather than 2025 or at the latest 2030. Extinction Rebellion is not tied to any specific party or ideology, and that helps us envision a whole other system. For us, capitalism is mainly degenerative economics, and we propose regenerative economics. One of the key words for us is degrowth, a way of thinking about society in which quality of life is valued more highly, far more highly, than is wealth in purely quantitative terms. But this is a disturbing concept to those conditioned to regard GDP as the chief standard by which the success of a society or a civilization is measured.
This is Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. And this week, we are returning to our discussion of the major policy proposals for how to address climate change and contrasting them with degrowth and circular economics.
It's important that we in the environmental movement not present degrowth as merely the less terrifying of two scary alternative futures. First, because such a claim would be a distortion, but also because nobody will buy into degrowth if people believe it's bad. Rather, we should see degrowth society as a positive goal, even irrespective of its impact on the climate. Of course, we're motivated by the climate crisis, but this idea has benefits beyond helping to fix climate change. The transition to a degrowth society from our current doomed system will no doubt be long, difficult, and painful, but the rewards will be much greater than the sacrifices.
One concept that may help bring about degrowth is called the circular economy. The linear economy, that is the current one, can be summarized as a cycle based on take, make, use, and lose. Take natural materials indiscriminately. Make things to sell, whether people really need them or not, like pet rocks, right? Use the things we buy, though they're not made to last, and then lose them by tossing them onto landfills or toxically destroying them or sending them to Africa. Take, make, use, and lose. Over two decades ago, the Rocky Mountain Institute estimated that of the half a trillion tons of natural materials that go into manufactured products worldwide each year, only 1% was usable. The other 99% was just waste. In the circular economic model, this enormous waste, the inevitable byproduct of the linear system, would be minimalized to the greatest degree possible. This would be achieved through the complete reorganization of manufacturing, distribution, and consumption processes, creating closed circular loops. The key words of circular economics are repair, reuse, remanufacture, refurbish, and recycle. In this way, our economy would become regenerative. Now, all those rewords reflect this circularity idea. For example, in Amsterdam, discarded tires that are normally destined for landfills are being shredded, right? Their components, rubber, steel, and other materials, are reused to create brand new tires or other household products. It's no brainer, right? However, there are admittedly several problems with this strategy. For most goods, like tires, there are only so many times one can recycle. Recycling involves the extensive use of electricity, which may be derived from fossil fuels. transporting goods to and from recycling plants may also involve fossil fuels. So ultimately, the circular economy can't be about one manufacturer changing its production cycle independent of others. This is about, you know, rethinking the entire system. Donut economics is a related idea that is also being much publicized. Well, though they're not good for us, we all like donuts, right? So is donut economics a tasty idea that's also somehow good for us? This concept is being put forward by Dr. Kate Raworth, an Oxford-trained economist who has worked for both the UN and Oxfam. Raworth traces the history of our current system to a meeting of 39 intellectuals that took place in the Swiss village of Pelerin in April 1947, led by Austrian-born economist Friedrich Hayek. I'm butchering his name, I'm sure. At that meeting, the foundations of what we today call neoliberalism were laid. This led some decades later to an unprecedented emphasis on free markets as the ideal way to organize society. But the frequent collapse of financial markets, despite this laissez-faire philosophy, of which the crash of 2007 was but one example, gives the lie to this ideology. As an alternative, Raworth suggests a different model, which she uses the image of a donut to convey. Now, the donut model is conceptualized as three concentric circular areas. First, the inner part, you know, corresponding to the hole in the donut. We all like donut holes. And it contains all the people, mostly the poor, who are not well served by the current system. These are people who lack food, housing, clean drinking water, and other essential services. Now, second is the outer ring. And beyond the donut, so to speak, is the area outside the limits of the natural world and its resources. It's dangerous to all humanity for us to venture into that outer ring, yet our society does so every day under the current system. Third is the middle ring. The donut itself is, according to Raworth, where we want to be. It's a place in which everyone's needs would be provided for within the limits of the planet's resources and its ecological balance. Here's audio from a YouTube interview with Dr. Raworth from 2019, conducted by Extinction Rebellion's co-founder, Dr. Gail Bradbrook, in which Raworth describes her theory in terms that anybody can understand.
Well, if you're an economist, we're no longer in ancient Greece when the household was, you know, a little estate. And how do you manage your slaves and do you let your wife run the books? We're no longer in Athens where the economy was a city state. We're no longer in Adam Smith's day when the economy was the nation state. We're here in a planetary household. We are the generation that realizes we are a planetary household. So any self-respecting 21st century economist has to start with the planetary household. And economics should start with understanding how this planetary household thrives, the hydrological cycle, the carbon cycle, all the living earth systems, and how her inhabitants thrive and the nature of people, that we're not deeply competitive and only self-interested, but also profoundly collaborative and collective. We're the most social of all animals. So I think all economics has to start there, and everybody gets that. I know when I first started writing about economics and I'd chat to parents at the school gate, they say, you know, what are you working on? I'm writing a book about economics. Everyone goes, I was never very good at maths. And I say, look, you know, the only maths in my book, the only numbers are the page numbers. We can all get this if we start with the fundamental values of the living planet, of human values and connection. We now can create the beginnings of ideas and principles for 21st century economics that actually make sense.
It should be noted that Dr. Raworth's concept is consistent with three of Extinction Rebellion's four demands. We demand that government tell the truth and act now about the climate crisis, that is, to stay within the outer limits of the donut. But we also demand a just transition to serve the needs of people of color and of poor communities not served by the current system. In other words, to get people out of the hole of the donut into the middle ring. Now, to test these ideas, a people's assembly was organized in a place called Heartlands in Cornwall, England. By coincidence, in the same English city, Cornwall, the G7 have been meeting this year, a gathering protested by many environmental activists, including Extinction Rebellion. The Cornwall People's Assembly was described on the Donut Economics Action Lab website with the following quote. An amazing, tricky, collective, challenging, collaborative, audacious day of beginning the process of understanding which direction we're facing in our current context of climate, economic, and social crises. It made for much scratching of heads as we fought with the best way of embracing this enormous level of complexity and brought out some hair-raising facts and some heartstormingly brilliant ideas for change. We talked about climate and change, about facts and behavior, about politics and community and fear, about loss and the past, about the future and injustice and soil and communication and poverty and systems and planning, banking and carbon and schools and food, and watched and heard and spoke and listened and ate together in Cornwall. This narrative, by the way, points to the third demand of Extinction Rebellion for citizens' assemblies, in which people in a given community from all walks of life debate issues such as climate change and arrive at decisions that governments are obligated to accept.
You have been listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney on WBAI 99.5 FM. And we're returning this week to our discussion of the major policy proposals for how to address climate change and contrasting them with ideas like degrowth and circular economics, and pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. Thank you for listening. We must not underestimate the difficulty of what people like Raworth are trying to accomplish by creating an alternative economic paradigm by which we can live. It's easy sometimes to forget how totally complicit we all are in the current system, even if we hate that system. For example, if you're like most people, including myself, as soon as you get up in the morning, you start turning on things that require power. Lights, coffee makers, phones, laptops, stoves. You're constantly using things and throwing them out. You may try to recycle or compost, knowing that those are inadequate responses to the crisis on a system level. And since you're listening to this program, you're doing so either through a radio or through the internet or a computer device of some sort. Either way, you're using energy for a non-essential purpose through machines that will never be properly broken down and reused after their lifespan is done. And for those of you who disagree that we're inessential, bless you, but inessential to life, we can all agree on that. The point of all this is not to make you, the listener, feel guilty. It's to impress upon you the sheer mind-boggling complexity of the dilemma we face in a strive to live collectively and sustainably. But there are bright spots to this troubling picture. One of them, strangely enough, in a way, is the COVID pandemic. COVID has shown us that we can act together and cooperate on a global scale in ways we previously would have scarcely thought possible. If we can change our way of thinking and acting because of an emergency like the pandemic, we can respond to this greater emergency too. Bill McKibben once called climate change, quote, the biggest thing that's ever happened, unquote. And either you believe in the literal truth of what he's saying or you don't. But if you believe McKibben, and we in Extinction Rebellion are inclined to believe him, that means that you realize that this crisis is bigger than all of the wars, famines, plagues, and other crises that humans have endured down the centuries. But government and corporate leaders throughout the world, particularly in the United States, act as if they believe no such thing. The solution thus will not come from Paris or the progressive wing of an established political party, and certainly not from the White House. So what is to be done? First, we can't let Biden go back on his promises. The election of Biden may not have been the solution, but we won't sit idly by while he remains part of the problem. We must insist, at a minimum, that he enact climate-friendly policies. He can do this simply through executive orders or, more complexly, through legislation that only needs a simple majority in the Senate, which the Democrats already have, to pass. The second thing is to go beyond Biden to reach people of all different races and classes and ideologies directly. It's necessary to spread the word about degrowth as an idea whose time has come. To do this, citizens' assemblies could be crucial. You can be sure that most of the assembly members in Cornwall never knew donut economics before they met. Nevertheless, they were able to work within the framework of that novel idea. In any case, by themselves, protest demonstrations and political papers about the climate won't do the trick. The third thing is to maintain an atmosphere of hope, even in times like these, when there seems so little to be hopeful about. As the great political activist and thinker Antonio Gramsci once said, we need to simultaneously cultivate, quote, pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will, unquote. Pessimism of the intellect means that you don't interpret every little flicker of hope as signifying some mystical light at the end of the tunnel. You don't underestimate how deep the problems are. Optimism of the will, on the other hand, means that you keep on fighting anyway, as if the turning point is just down the road, because maybe, just maybe, it is. You don't let the difficulty of challenge defeat your will to keep trying to make a better world. With these two attributes, pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will, we activists can lead by example, no matter what the politicians do.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
They came after Julian, not for his vices, but for his virtues.
Journalist Chris Hedges on why the persecution of Julian Assange.
They came after Julian because he exposed the more than 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, because he exposed the torture and abuse of some 800 men and boys aged between 14 and 89 at Guantanamo. Because he exposed that Hillary Clinton, in 2009, ordered U.S. diplomats to spy on U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and other U.N. representatives from China, France, Russia, and the U.K., spying that included obtaining DNA, iris scans, fingerprints, and personal passwords, part of the long pattern of illegal surveillance that included the eavesdropping on UN Secretary General Kofi Annan in the weeks before the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. Because he exposed that Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and the CIA orchestrated the June 2009 military coup in Honduras that overthrew the democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya, replacing it with a murderous and corrupt military regime. Because he exposed that George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and David Petraeus prosecuted a war in Iraq that under post-Nuremberg laws is defined as a criminal war of aggression, a war crime. That they authorized hundreds of targeted assassinations, including those of U.S. citizens in Yemen, and that they secretly launched missile, bomb, and drone attacks on Yemen, killing scores of civilians. Because he exposed that Goldman Sachs paid Hillary Clinton $657,000 to give talks, a sum so large it can only be considered a bribe. And that she privately assured corporate leaders she would do their bidding while promising the public financial regulation reform. Because he exposed the internal campaign to discredit and destroy British Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn by members of his own party. Because he exposed how the hacking tools used by the CIA and the National Security Agency permits the wholesale government surveillance of our televisions, computers, smartphones, and antivirus software, allowing the government to record and store our conversations, images, and private text messages, even from encrypted apps.
Tune in to Radio Unnameable Thursday at midnight to hear Hedges and more on the power of moral resistance and the importance of protecting whistleblowers and journalists and to advocate for the release of Julian Assange. That's midnight on Thursday, Radio Unnameable, here on listener-sponsored, non-commercial, locally controlled WBAI New York.
With an urgent message. The WBAI local station board urges members to vote no in the bylaws referendum. The board voted unanimously to reject the proposed bylaw changes, which will strip power from local boards and unpaid staff. Four officers will, without election, assume power on a shrunken national board. Three of these four supported the illegal shutdown of WBAI in 2019 that turned us into a repeater station. Vote no to save our station from takeover and possible sale. Mumia Abu-Jamal, Danny Glover, Harry Belafonte,